I want to thank CPR CNA 26 for asking me to share. And it's funny, when I got the phone call, I think I can say this, I was working at a place. The topic is we are a vision of hope. Mm-hmm. I was working at a place called A Beacon of Hope. When I got the phone call, it was my last day working there. And it was by choice, but it was just ironic how the topic came on my last day. If y'all can't tell, y'all should know I'm nervous, right? Wim, thank you so much. Thank you. I am grateful to be amongst the land of the living. Before I came to Narcotics Anonymous, my clean date is November 22nd, 2001. I have had many excuses to use. I just have not used. And I know it wasn't because of me. It was because of His grace. That I know. So before I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I'm a product of a single-parent home. My mother raised me to the best of her ability. She gave me everything I needed, I wanted, and more. She made sure I went to the best schools. She made sure I did the dance. She made sure I did the karate. She made sure I did everything so that I would not be out there. She taught me principles. She taught me values. And somewhere along the line, those things got away from me. My father was an alcoholic, and I heard another girl from our area share this, and I was never going to be an alcoholic. It wasn't until I came to Narcotics Anonymous that I found out that alcohol was a drug. I was not going to be like my father. You know, I would go and I would find him, and I don't know, I'm from Southeast Washington, and you know, it used to be a place called Clancy's, and I would go and knock on the door, and I'd say, can you get my father out, please? And he'll come out there drunk as, and that's how I was. But my father and mother never kept me from him. He was always in my life. I remember, my father never telling me that he loved me. Okay, I'm going to skip all over that. I got some glasses, I got a book, and I ain't read none of this, right? But look, let me say this. At 12, I started smoking cigarettes. At 13, I started smoking marijuana. At 13, I was raped. And that led to a life of being promiscuous. And so through school and all that kind of stuff, I made honor roll. I did all that and came out 1 year of college, and I decided I didn't want to do college no more. Back in the 80s, that was called freebasing. I had a taste of that, and I thought I was in. It was a rich man's high. That's what they told me. How many know about the first one, being free? So I was in a relationship with a guy who was my high school sweetheart. He went away to the military. And he wanted to marry me. But because I had started using this substance, right, I couldn't keep in touch with him. And he would write me, and I would duck him every time he came home. Of course, I didn't want him to see me like that. So I was in a relationship with a man who beat my tail for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I thought it was okay because he loved me and I loved him. And thank you. I didn't even know what love was. I knew the love from a parent. I knew the love from you know, my family, my cousins and all that. And by the way, I'm one of four of my father. I'm my mother's only child. So, anyway. Okay, my mind is not my friend. Anyway, I'm telling you. Okay, I don't know where I was. But, and I don't even know why I said all that. Anyway, Okay, right. Okay, so thank you. Thank you. See, therapeutic value of one addict helping another. Okay, so father was alcoholic, grew up. She never, kept me from him. Went to school, I talked about the relationship, that's where I was. And so getting out of this relationship, the only way I could see, if I got out the relationship, I wouldn't get high. I would do something different. I was working in the government said, okay, there's something wrong. What's wrong? Well, apparently something is wrong because I stole the girl's graduation money that I had collected to give her a graduation gift. But at that time, I didn't see that as being wrong. They said, okay, well, you can go and get some counseling. That means you won't, you know, you can't lose your job right now, but you can go and get some counseling. And needless to say, I went to two sessions and I was done. I was cured. And left the relationship, didn't use that substance, but I continued to use marijuana. And so my motto used to be, I'm going to be an old lady and I'm going to be sitting in a rocking chair, and that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life because I liked the way it made me feel. And needless to say, I was tall for my age, and so I never liked how I looked. I never felt a part of, even though I may have acted as if, I didn't feel that way. I had big lips. I love my lips today, right? taller than everybody. It was just, it was just the way I felt. Anyway, let me move the story up. So I, years later, I decided, my mother used to tell me that, Ursula, you're trying to do everything now, and when you get older, you're not going to have anything to do. And I was like, I don't know what she's talking about. I was go-going, in high school and, going to the clubs, and I look older so I could get into the clubs and, all that kind of stuff. And so that thing meant that I was grown. I was growing up, but I really didn't know how to grow up. Because somewhere, and it probably was when that first substance that I had, that I stopped growing, right? Anyway, I get here and it's like the 90s now and I have nothing to do. So what do? Me and my friends and my family, we decide, okay, we'll just, do a little something else, and we stay around the house and play cards and, we be good. The club thing ain't no more, That ended up with me going back to smoking, at this time crack. And so here I was. At that time it was Wooters, and so I thought that I was cool. It was all right. I wasn't doing the other thing, so I was okay. Needless to say, when the marijuana ran out, I knew exactly what to do with the crack. So there's my life over again. I'm using, and I can't stop. I'm still working. Right? And my mother's saying, you need some help. And I'm saying, I don't need no help. My stepfather said, I'm taking you to the doctors and you're going to get some counseling. And he took me to the counseling session. And I came right out of that counseling session and I used. Soon as he went to work, I used. And when he came home, all the doors was bolted up and I had chairs up under the doors because now I'm in paranoia. I got everything going on. But ain't nothing wrong with me. And so he busts in the house, and I got, my bedroom had glass pool doors, right? My closet was glass doors. And inside of it had an attic. When I got high, that attic seemed like everything was coming up out of it, right? So I get up in the attic, and I start banging nails because now I'm scared. I'm scared, but I still don't need any help. I went to my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous in April of 2000. I sat in that meeting and I cried and I cried and I cried. And I left out that meeting and continued to use. It was only months later, August of 2000, I was back via psych ward. I had stolen my mother's money. I had started writing checks on her account, but I still didn't need any help. And the only reason I went to the psych ward was because that was the only place that would accept me that night. My mother and my son had gone to church. I had gone out to do something I said I would never do, which was buy from a child. And I went and bought from that child, and because that child beat me, I started stealing her money. And I started writing her checks. And so I knew I better be gone by the time she get home. I got to the psych ward, and the doctor said, only thing wrong with you is that you are, suffering from crack-induced depression. We can't keep you here unless you're going to try to kill yourself. I said, okay. I just told the story the other night. So he said, well, you said you're going to take a bottle of Tylenols and you're going to kill yourself. And I said, okay, whatever. And he said, and then I looked at him and I said, doctor, you kill yourself off Tylenols? He was like, yeah, it's slow and painful, but you can do it. He said, okay, we're going to admit you to the fourth floor, da-da-da, whatever, and I'm not knowing where I'm going. And he says, and you're going to be up there, and it's a locked ward, and da-da-da-da. And here goes my first visit to the psych ward. But before I get up there, I ask him, how crazy are these people? And he looks at me, but he politely escorted me up to the fourth floor. Thus began my first recovery with Narcotics Anonymous. And you heard I said first. I got in there, and all the way, through all the journeys, I got in there, and my counselor was this guy, and he was in, I'll say he was in Alcoholics Anonymous. But that man gave me so much hope, whereas I thought that I really didn't need no help. Everybody said to me, from the doctor to this counselor, you know you don't have to use anymore. And I get up there and this man is counseling me, but also H&I brings in a meeting. I ain't know nothing about H&I then. Only I knew was a meeting was coming in. And I said, oh, I've been to one of them meetings. I'm going to this one. And I met some people. And I came out. And I started going to meetings. And I got a home group. And I got a sponsor, and I did a couple steps, and 1, 2, 3 to be exact. And I got another job. My meetings got less. I stayed here 9 months. Now I picked up my 9th month key tag, and it was only a couple weeks I was using again. So I knew how to not use for a while. So if I can only use on the weekends, I'll be fine. They don't know what they're talking about. But let me tell you this. When I picked up that first one again, I rode the whole beltway. I passed the stop where I would normally stop to go use. I circled the beltway. Circled it again. And then I stopped. That was a lot of work. Anyway. I had told you I got a new job. I got to this job and didn't realize until after they told me that I have to go and I have to have a breathalyzer. And I said, oh, I got them because I don't drink. I should have known that it was only going to be a week later and they was telling me they were going to take me for urine, right? So the day they asked me to come in and take the urine, I walk in the door. I'm high. It's a good job, but I can't stop using. So they take me for the urine. What I found out after that, my boss is escorting me to the place to take my urine. See, had I tapped into the program of Narcotics Anonymous, I would have known that who I was working with were recovering addicts. And she says to me, you know you don't have to use. So between that time, in November 22nd of 2001, I went to 5 psych wards. And each one said, you know you don't have to use. I met this lady and I have not seen her since. She had 10 years clean. And she was at the psych ward. And I asked her, what are you doing here if you got 10 years clean? She said, my son died. My husband died. She said, all within months of each other. And she said, I thought I better check in before I check out. I came out of there, out of my last cycle, and I started attending meetings. And I went back to my old home group, and I went back to my old sponsor, and I came out of there, and I was going to IOP, and my counselor was the same counselor there the first time I tried recovery. And so I went back there, and I'd like to say that November 22nd, 2001, when I came out, I didn't use again. I did. And this is my story. I was pregnant. I was 3 months pregnant, and I was still using. I thought it was okay to use because I had friends who used. It was okay. I made a decision. I made a decision to keep this child, but yet I was harming her. And so I'm riding down the highway. This is my last time. I'm riding down the highway, and I'm puking, and I'm taking a hit. I'm puking, I'm hitting. I'm puking, I'm hitting. I won't stop. Only thing I know is that I'm empty. And I can't take it anymore. All I want to do is die. This is God before I even knew that it was God. My car I was in, I tried to run it off the road because I feel as if I just die, I wouldn't be a disappointment to my mother. I wouldn't be, oh, I had a son. I wouldn't be a disappointment to my son. If I would just die, this child does not have to come and see a parent like this. Mm-hmm. But the car cuts off. Cut slam off. It wouldn't start back up. Only thing I know now, I'm crying and I'm pissy. Right? That's one thing that I never liked, but that's what I became in active addiction. I would pee anywhere. And if it meant peeing on myself, that's what I would do. So that's like how I smell, pissy, right? So this man stops. He sees me on the side of the road. He stops. He asks me, ma'am, you okay? I'm fine. I'm an addict. Can you please just take me to the hospital? He takes me to the hospital, and thus my journey begins. November 22nd, 2001. I meant to say November 17th, but anyway. November 22nd, 2001, my journey began. And I came in the room, and I sat down. I didn't move, because the area I came in is Tri-County area, and you talked about the, you just wanted to see some black people. Sometimes I felt like, did black people recover? because sometimes I would be the only one sitting in there. And then if they came in, sometimes, I'm talking about early in recovery now. So when they first came in, I mean, when they would come in, they would either come in, not stay, they'd leave, you know, and I'd be the only one still sitting there again. But guess what? They all love me. So the women I came up with, they told me, sit down, right? This is what they would be sharing. They would say, sit down. If you got to sit on your hands, do that. You only got an hour or an hour and a half, depending on the meeting. Just sit down, listen. And so I didn't know how to listen. So I had to learn. I had to learn how to listen. And that was hard at times. But I sat down and I did it. And I stayed here. And one day at a time, they would just love me. And they would just hug me. And they told me I would love you. We would love you until you began to love yourself. And so my first vision of hope was you all. 2002. I just had my child. My mother had been diagnosed and said she had to have a double bypass. So I never seen my mother sick because she's always been a working person. So she was sick. She went and had surgery. I didn't know what to do. Only thing y'all told me was do was just show up. And so I showed up. And so I get there. And my cousins, you know, they're afraid I'm going to use. So they come and they join me at the hospital. She went through that double bypass and I didn't use. But what came out of that, this is how you all helped me. I didn't know how to cook. I knew how to cook like bacon, eggs, you know, that kind of stuff, but to cook her a meal, because now she had to change her diet. So you women told me, gave me recipes, and showed me what to do for my mother. See, I didn't know how to do that. I was 36 years old and didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to take care of my mother because I expected my mother was supposed to take care of me. 2003, my girlfriend, she committed suicide. When you saw me coming to meet, you saw her behind me. If I walked in, you saw her, you know, however it was. And she decided that she no longer wanted to be clean. She's the one that really got me into, like, thrusting myself into service. Hope. Whew. She got me into service. I didn't even know what service was. Only thing I know is she went to treatment and she came back and she was happy-go-lucky for Narcotics Anonymous. And I was like, why is she so happy? She started taking me to meetings outside of my area. We didn't know what to do, but there was a meeting that had fallen. And she said, she started asking people what to do. And they said, put out some flyers and get some help. They said, y'all just going to show up and do what you got to do. They didn't call the service. They just told us to show up, right? Go make the coffee. We made the coffee. We were newcomers. We didn't know what to do, but because you all told us that's what we were supposed to do, that's what we did. So she dies. 2004, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And again, she was diagnosed with cancer. All I could see was the end. I didn't see any hope. I saw, because I had lost my father previous years to cancer, that that's what was going to happen to my mother. And so she said I treated her like she had the plague. She said, I would stand at the top of the steps and say, Ma, you okay? You need anything? Because I still didn't know. I'm still learning. I'm going through steps, but I'm learning. And 2005, they told her she was in remission, and but she had caught an infection. So she's in the hospital, and she's in the hospital, and we get a phone call from my grandfather, my grandfather and my aunt and my older sister, they were all coming, my nephew, were all coming up to visit us and plus go to my uncle's funeral. Well, we get the phone call while we're at the hospital that they didn't make it. I said, what do you mean they didn't make it? said they died. And the only person who came up out of it was my nephew. And he had a scratch. That's it. That was the first time I got in touch with. When I ask God, when I make a decision to turn my will and my life over, and knowing that he has my best interest, that I leave it there. That was the first time I didn't feel like I wanted to crumble. That was the first time that my family leaned on me to say, we need help. Y'all told me, we'll take care of your mother in the hospital. You go down there and bury your family. People don't understand why I'm passionate about Narcotics Anonymous. Because it saved my life. And so I go down there, and I've been to funerals, all that kind of stuff, but I've never buried anybody. You know, like from the process, from the beginning to the end. And so I got to make sure that my sister's lipstick is okay. That's too dark. Can you please change it? My aunt has on a pink dress, and they got this burgundy lipstick. She don't even wear that. Can you take it off? Y'all called me, and y'all told me it was going to be okay. We got your mother. They even came and got her out the hospital and took her home. This is what Narcotics Anonymous has done for me. So I dare me be selfish. No. Okay, that was 2005. So we buried him, and I come home. My nephew comes home with us. He's kind of, I won't say he's slow, but he has, I can't think of it. He got something. He has a mental diagnosis. And so they wouldn't let him stay with us. They put him in a group home. They put him in a group home because now he done lost his whole world. They put him in a group home, and we really can't have access. But guess what? He's comfortable in being in a group home. One of the family members said they didn't think we were capable of taking care of him. Anyway, 2006, I was doing a second fourth step, and my sponsor decided that she was going to let us go. And we had to fend for ourselves. Now, I had just got in touch with the third step, right? Like, that was my second third step, but that's like when I really got the meaning of it. You know, they said as long as you stay here, the steps take on new meaning. I was the kind that the third step tells me to turn my will and my life over, and I'm supposed to leave it, and sometimes we take it back, but we can start our day over at any time. But what I would do is, as long as everything is going good, I was fine. But let something go wrong, and I'm done. I'm angry. I'm angry. You know, I need to say that when my mother did have, when she was diagnosed with cancer, I was angry. And I was angry at God. And I couldn't understand how he can do it to me. Y'all hear me say, do it to me. And so when I got in touch with that, I learned today that, you know, just to leave it there. And it may not be what I want or what I like, but I just leave it there. You know, recently, I was going to say something else, but I forgot. But anyway, recently, I was working at this job. Since I've been in recovery, I've lost two jobs, not by my choice, but either by grant or by whatever. So this last job, when they let us let the team go, we and look, that's when I got in touch with standing for some and fall for anything. Anyway, they let us go, and I was on unemployment. So I was on unemployment for I forgot how long, when was it, 2010? Was it 2010 I lost a job? I think. Anyway, I was on unemployment, and I was liking being at home, relaxing a little bit, you know, but then it was time to get back out there and be a productive member of society again. And so I get out there and I start working temp. So we know that temp doesn't pay as much as what I would have made, right? They call me and they tell me they got a temp position. I'm working these places and it's all with the government, the St. Mary's County government, so I'm working. They call and they tell me that they got a position for me long term, $8 an hour. I'm like, what? Do you know how much I'm worth? Right. I know that temp make a little less, but darn, $8 an hour? My ego wanted to say, don't take that job. My mother says, tell them to go. She said something else, but anyway, she was like, tell them to go, you know. And I thought about it. And I rolled through that thing. And so I accepted the position. And I've been working temp there. And the position came available. No, let me tell you this. So I got hopeless on the job. I asked the director, do you think that my position, which is an admin, that's mostly what I've always been, and made good money at it, right? Do you think this position will become available? And she tells me no. Now I'm hopeless. Why they got me long term then, right? I can only see my sights on this position. I can't see nothing else. I can't see the man that's grooming me, by the way, who's a recovering addict. I can't see him grooming me because he's teaching me. But because the only thing I know how to do is to be a secretary, and I'm not saying nothing wrong with it, that's all I can see. So I stay here, and I persevere. I'm trying to get a job, but now I'm telling my manager, she'll say, Ursula, can you scan this for me? I'll be like, no. What's wrong with you? So she tiptoes around me. Ursula, can you type the minutes for me? Did I take the minutes? I typed my own minutes. Can't you type your own minutes? I didn't hear what you heard. I'm trying to tell y'all now. I'm going to help y'all in a minute. So I stayed there anyway. And I go through, but we're developing a relationship, her and I. And so I stay there. A job offer comes available. The guy who's grooming me, his job becomes available. Because he got another job, he got to come up, right? He says, you should apply. I say, what? He says, you should apply. I can't do that. What you mean apply? It took me to the 11th hour to apply for that position. I go on an interview, right? I go on my first interview, and because I can't see past my hand, the interview goes, well, what do you do in your job? No, what do you do on a daily basis? What's the question again? Well, what is it that you do with the program? Well, I screwed it up, right? But all these people that's interviewing me, oh, and I need to say it was a panel interview. So, like, I've never been in front of four people interviewing me at one time, and all these questions coming at me. But anyway, because they knew my ability, they gave me a second chance. And I came out of there, though, the first time crying, like I had failed. Like I just screwed up. But I did that to myself because I already talked myself down that I can't do the job. So I go back for the second interview. And the director, she pulls me first. She said, you know you can do this. Hope, the manager of the department, she says, look, if I was your girlfriend and she asked you what you do, tell her. If your husband said, what do? You tell her. You just run it off your mouth, right? Go in there and do that. hope. I go in, I don't even know this lady that's sitting at the front when I'm going into this interview. She says, you can do it. And so I walk in there now because I prayed. And people have given me hope, and they believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. I'm talking about here and now. I'm talking about with some step work that I still feel as though I don't deserve. I go in that interview. I didn't care if I got the job. Only thing I cared about was that I showed up and I did what was right. And I came out that job and I was skipping. Out that interview, I was like, yes! You know, and so my manager, she pulls me in after. She said, what does it mean? What did it mean to you? Because I heard you, right? Like, I came out there clapping. I was like, yes! You know, I knew that I had done a great job. But guess what? What I realized, I asked God to help me first. See, the first time I went in on Shear, just me. I thought I said, God, help me with this interview, but I didn't. This time I asked God to help me. So anyway, make a long story short, y'all, I got the job. Yeah. I am the admin coordinator of mental health. If I had left, or if I had let my pride get in the way, and my ego take over of getting that job, of even stepping in there, I wouldn't even have been at the Beacon of Hope. Let's say that. I wouldn't have got this job because I wouldn't have met the people that I've met so far. So I've been in services. I've been here. I'm going to close this up. How much time I got? 7 minutes. Okay, good. I've been in service since I walked in the door. My first service position was making coffee. My second position was going to area service. I've been in area service. This is my first year that I have not been there. I have been everything from the GSR. I've been the GSR. I've been the, vice chair of area, and just recently the chair of area. And that you all thought enough of me to even put me there. That my home group even thinks enough of me to put me as a GSR. So this year I took off. Not of service, though, but not at area. I continue to do service. And my first H&I service position, Michael S. right there, he had somebody to call me to ask me, did I want to do it? And I did that. And I'm back on H&I. So I was going to say something else. But anyway, I took off this year from area service because I wanted to do something that I love doing, and that's liturgical dancing. And somebody told me, don't go off on a religious zeal. Ain't got nothing to do with that. Because I don't even call what I practice religion. I call it spiritual. And so I like liturgical dancing. And that's what I'm back doing. And so I can't do it on Wednesdays. The 12th step really was what talks about we're our vision of hope. And when I think about that, I think about all the people that have come before me and who was here when I got here, who showed me the way, who helped me in times when I couldn't help myself. It talks about we. This means us, right? And even though it could be me in a meeting with all white people, it don't matter. It doesn't matter. None of that matters when it's time to stay clean. So some call me spiritual, and they can say that it's okay. I'm good with that. Some people say all you talk about is NA, and I'm good with that. They say, you talk about God. He's mine. I can talk about him. And so I try to, the same way people guide me, I try to guide others. And I try to show up and be that beacon. That hope so that you know that you never have to use again. And I don't care what you go through, and that's what y'all told me. I don't care what you do. You ain't got to use. I don't care what happens, you don't have to use. And so I stand here with 3,795 days of not using. My name is Ursa, and I'm an addict.